Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Lucy Suchek. Today we take you to Colby College in Waterville for the 2019 Lovejoy Award, a panel discussion honoring the journalists who sacrificed their lives in 2018. We'll hear from Hala Al-Dosari, the Washington Post's inaugural Jamal Khashoggi Fellow, Quill Lawrence, the veterans correspondent for NPR News, and Martin Smith, the producer of The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, a recent PBS Frontline documentary focusing on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. We'll also listen to clips from the documentary and hear a question and answer session following the panel discussion. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and it will be archived on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to hear the program again at your convenience and to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. The program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing the discussion today is Quill Lawrence, the veterans correspondent for NPR News.
Thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be here and see this full house coming out to hear about this important documentary and about the life of Jamal Khashoggi and his importance to the freedom of the press. I want to jump right in because we've got a lot to talk about and we really also want to hear your questions. But just briefly, that chilling list up there, I mean, it's very sobering. You read the names, and some you may have heard of, some you haven't. You know, each one has a story behind it. I think what sticks out for me, though, is that in recent years, this number has remained disturbingly high. But in talking to the Committee to Protect Journalists this week before coming to speak with you all, they told me that the number who are murdered has shot up. So whereas some of these people were killed in car bombs, they were casualties but not targeted, over half were targeted for murder, some of them by state actors. And that's why we're focusing among all those on the list on Jamal Khashoggi. And that high rate of murder is accompanied by a really disturbing rate of impunity. About 90% of these murders go unsolved. So I'm going to ask both of our panelists really just to introduce to you the Jamal Khashoggi that they knew, and then we'll get to see some of the film, which I hope some of you have seen already, and if you haven't, I would definitely recommend it. But Hala, why don't you start, because you wrote a wonderful column which I assume pegged to the anniversary of his murder this week, talking about the different ways that you and he looked at what's happening in Saudi Arabia.
So Jamal was very much like a product of the system in Saudi Arabia, someone who has been sponsored and embraced by the Saudi monarchy for decades throughout all of his career, basically. So he is an editor-in-chief of several newspapers in Saudi Arabia. He always leaned towards doing his independent journalism, but within the red lines allowed by the regime. For so many years, he worked also as a consultant for the intelligence services under one of the members of the ruling family, as a spokesperson for embassies. And throughout his career, he created this kind of several networks of correspondents, of policy influencers and framers.
He was an insider.
Within and outside Saudi Arabia, yeah. But he had this gentle personality, and I think what happened in Saudi Arabia with the rise of the Crown Prince since 2015 has pushed him out of the approved, basically, personalities within the media circles inside Saudi Arabia. It became more aggressive, more ultra-nationalists. He saw many of his friends and colleagues, journalists, worked with him or worked in different platforms being rounded up. And he was ordered to basically stop talking to the media or write for any kinds of outlets. This is, I think, where he made his decision to come to the U.S. So when I asked him in my first interaction with him, I'm someone who also has written for an op-ed column for about 8 years in a Saudi newspaper before I get fed up from the censorship and decided to stop. So when he came to the US, this was the first time ever for me to engage with him over one of his articles. And he said to me that his decision basically to break loose with the system and decide to be independent and living abroad is when he got this phone call. He said, this reduced me so much, this phone call that came after decades of working for my government, that asked me, you know, an insider, I assume it was Saud al-Qahtani, who's a henchman of Mohammed bin Salman, where they asked him to stop writing or doing any media interviews. And he said, I felt so much reduced to the point that I decided I'm not gonna remain silent anymore. And of course, seeing his friends and colleagues doing that. And when I asked him, how come you changed camps altogether? You're not writing with the same, attitudes as before. You're not basically living within the same red lines. He said, I'm a work in progress. And I think it shows how brutal the regime has shaped and influenced his transition.
So, Martin, you'd had many conversations with Jamal Khashoggi before you decided to make this film. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think it's important to mention that Jamal was somebody that Western journalists, outsiders, came to regularly because he was very much a spokesperson for the regime. He was the spokesman at the embassy, the Saudi embassy in London, and then in Washington. He was, as Hala said, he was an insider. He was part of the system. But he had this urge about him to speak to the truth as close as he could get, and that wasn't very close, frankly. What is interesting that I want to add to this phone call that he gets that tells him he can no longer write or tweet or appear on TV.
What had he said? What triggered that?
Well, this is what's interesting, and it speaks to the relationship between Mohammed bin Salman and Donald Trump, and that was that it wasn't that he had criticized the Crown Prince. He came out on a teleconference into a think tank in Washington and criticized, didn't even criticize. He warned that we should be very careful about how we look at the new incoming Trump administration. This was enough to get the perception of the Crown Prince that he was somehow standing between him and the Trump administration. And that's when he got the order. It wasn't that he'd criticized the Crown Prince, that he would somehow got in between the Crown Prince and the Trump administration, and therefore was told he could no longer write or tweet or appear on television. And then it was many months of frustration before he decided he would come to the US. I sat down with him again at that point, and he was really sort of unsure about what he wanted to do next. He was thinking about it. He didn't want to, like Hala, he didn't want to go back to Saudi Arabia because he knew he would be put under a travel ban and not allowed to work. And so it was a few weeks after that he published his first piece in the Washington Post. Yeah.
Let me ask you both just to talk a little bit briefly about Mohammed bin Salman and who people thought he might be and who he turned out to be before we watch the first clip, which is about the murder of Khashoggi. So Martin, go first.
Well. I think there's a lot of confusion about the so-called reformer that he has been perceived to be. He is a reformer. He wants to open up the country. He wants to diversify the economy. He wants to bring women into the workforce. But a lot of confusion has circled around this idea that somehow that means he's in favor of free speech or political reform or people's right to self-determination. That's not what he's interested in. Very much on the sort of China model, he wants to invigorate the economy. He knows that it's a failing proposition to keep going forward as they are dependent on oil. And he wants to therefore build a different base for that economy. But he wants, like the Chinese, to keep a firm grip on free speech and any kind of aspirations that people have to determine what kind of country they're going to live in. He's going to control it.
And Hala, I think you could speak to that very specifically in terms of the infamous women's driving ban in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, so Mohammed bin Salman really, really very much like emphasized what the absolute monarchy is about. Basically controlling and consolidating all kinds of power within the state and not allowing any kinds of independent or organic movement of civil society agents to influence the public outside of the control of the state. Very much like the China model, but more of very much like in line with what's happening after the Arab revolutions. As Martin mentioned, it was...
Which we call the Arab Spring, right?
Yes. Yeah. So basically, I think it was from 2014 when Saudi Arabia was very much with the oil prices fluctuating and going in decline, that the International Monetary Fund, for instance, mentioned that if Saudi Arabia did not control its public spending, sector spending, they will go into bankruptcies in a few years. So it was crucial to reform the economy. And this is a trigger for allowing more of a social mobility, social freedom, and somehow remove the restrictions that would not allow people, especially the women, the majority of unemployed people in Saudi Arabia are women, to be part of the workforce, like the restrictions on driving, on travel, obtaining documentations, things of this sort, being able to work in a safe place, the anti-sexual harassment law that was passed at that time, the non-discrimination in applying for work between men and women, also passed in this time. So the intent of reform is very important when looking at the nature of those reforms that happened when Mohammed bin Salman came. So until now, women are not allowed to go against their guardian's wishes and use those kinds of opportunities.
Meaning that they have to be accompanied by a man?
No, the men still have the authority to report them as disobedient or missing from homes. So those two types of overarching control of men over women in the family restrict the ability of women to make any kinds of use of those kinds of reforms. So yes, for the traditional segments of society, the conservatives, yes, that would be more challenging to change because with the changes in the law or with the policies, there is no accompanying change in the traditional norms or the cultural norms in which the women activists and the civil society agents were heavily engaged in writing about or talking about or exposing those kinds of problems and raising and amplifying the voices of marginalized groups, including the women. So I think the move to go against all those kinds of civil agents, whether they were religious reformers or intellectuals, women activists, came because the state is not very much tolerant to people who are trying to influence the spaces, the community outside the control of the state. And this is something that came after very much like part of the media, the campaign of the state media, basically. The state is trying to create those kinds of narrative, the public narrative, on what it means to be a Saudi, what it means to be in a modernizing world, what is the expectation. It sets the society for what is expected, basically, from the state, and what is an expectation from a citizen in terms of how they behave, how they relate to the state or their identities. And this is part of the control on the voices in the public space and why the women were viciously attacked as agents of the West or traitors and things like that.
All right, we've got so much to talk about, and we'll get to your questions after, I think, because this is so provocative. But why don't you set up a clip?
Quill, we're talking about women now, so I want to reverse the order that we were going to play
the clip. Can we play the second clip first?
Let's play the second clip first. I just want to set it up by mentioning that there is this reference to Saad al-Qahtani, who was an extremely close aide, who carried out some of the more draconian sessions of torture and interrogations of people in the kingdom. His name will come up here. I just want you to recognize who that is. So let's run the second clip first, because it deals with women, and that's what we're talking about right now.
At least 12 women and 3 men were arrested because of their activism. Human rights groups believe the number to be much higher. Khashoggi wrote, "Repression and intimidation are not, and never should be, the acceptable companions of reform." He urged MBS to order the release of Hathloul and the other women who campaigned for women's right to drive. But they were not released. Hathloul's parents were not allowed to start visiting her until months later.
My mom and my father went to Jeddah. They took the plane to visit Lujain at Dahban prison. When they saw her, she was weak, very weak, and there was red marks over her face. They asked her, "Did they torture you?" And she said, she said, "No, I'm fine, don't worry about me." And they insisted. And after that, she just started crying. She couldn't stop. And at the moment, she stopped. She started breathing. And she showed them her thighs. And it was not only bruises, it was burnt. It was so dark. And she said they were going to throw me in the sewage system. And they were repeating this to her. She thought she was going to die. And during the torture session, she recognized specifically one man, and he is a highly ranked advisor.
Who was that?
His name is known everywhere. It was Saud al-Qahtani.
Some of the other women arrested also endured torture. Samar Badawi, Aziza al-Yusuf, Iman al-Nafshan, Shadan al-Anesi, and Nof al-Dosari. There are also reports of sexual harassment and assault. Details were sent by multiple sources to human rights groups outside Saudi Arabia.
The statement that we got from many of the sources that all of the women were tortured and placed, of course, in solitary confinement. Women would be stripped naked and assaulted sexually. They would be beaten, electrocuted. To see those women who have for years been really a source of strength for other women, to see them treated this way, for me, I know these women. I know how dignified, how caring and concerned about their country they are. There is no other way except that they want to put them into a position where they're completely broken and silenced.
It's a really moving film if you haven't seen it. I want to talk a little bit about Saud al-Qahtani. He is the link, I suppose, or the closest that people have gotten, really, to linking Mohammed bin Salman to the murder.
Right. We trace his career within the royal court. He headed something called the Center for Studies and Media Affairs, which sounds rather innocent. He initially was used to monitor Twitter to use his ability to put together an army which could monitor and then influence people on Twitter. He moved from that into interrogations of people in various situations with the arrests at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel that some of you, I'm sure, have heard about. He was a chief interrogator there. And then with the women here who wanted to simply advocate for women to drive, actually they wanted more than that, but they were arrested just before the driving ban was lifted for reasons that are not altogether clear. We can speculate that he didn't want to let them take credit for something that the Crown Prince was beneficently giving to the people. But in any case, he became an interrogator there. And then he is believed to be the chief, the person who executed Jamal Khashoggi by monitoring the group from outside, probably from Riyadh. But it was his team, it was his employees that went to Istanbul and carried out that grisly murder. So he's very close to Mohammed bin Salman. Mohammed bin Salman told me himself, it's in the film, that he texts with him every day, including on October 2nd, the day of the murder.
Do you want to just go ahead and set up the second clip?
Sure. We can run that. I want to run this. This is more germane to the idea of, well, this is about Jamal Khashoggi. This is his final days. I don't think I have to say much more, and we can go right into it.
Right. So play the first clip, please. And sorry about the curveball to the AV.
In D.C., Khashoggi was also feeling the wrath of MBS. His son, Salah, the only one of his children still in Saudi Arabia, had been forbidden to travel.
One of the first things he said to me is, they've put my son on a travel ban, and it's just not fair. He's not political at all, and there's nothing I can do about it.
And my understanding is that he sent a message to Saud al-Qahtani telling him, this has come to very low standards, that you are now going after my son. But he received no response from Saud al-Qahtani.
His wife, fearing for her and her family's safety, asked for a divorce.
And that was extremely painful to him.
Jamal was also being harassed on Twitter by Qahtani's notorious army of flies.
What we talked about is, did I know anybody at Twitter to turn it off? It was the bots, the army, the flies.
I can say that there was certainly a sense of animus towards Jamal Khashoggi because of his unrelenting criticism of the kingdom in a national newspaper in the capital of the Saudis' closest partner.
And I think MBS felt genuinely threatened by this Washington Post-supported journalist who was criticizing MBS himself personally.
He talked about the kind of threats he was getting, but he was also heartened by the positive feedback he was getting from Saudis he never met. And people reaching out to him and saying, yes, you are doing the right thing. Yes, you are speaking on all of our behalf. Thank you for doing what you are doing.
And he had, with time, found a new love, someone who shared his interest in Arab politics, a Turkish academic, Hatice Cengiz.
When I saw him the last time, he was happy. He said, well, I'm thinking I'm going to spend more time in Turkey now.
And he kept writing about the prince he had once supported.
I think his ultimate desire was to see his people enjoy some of the same freedoms that he had here in Washington, in the U.S.
He submitted his last article on September 28, 2018.
Over time, I think Jamal felt more and more that independent journalism was the way to achieve what he'd wanted since he was a young man. George Orwell gave as a title of the column that he wrote, As I Please, meaning I write as I please. Jamal Khashoggi was a version of that. He was somebody who wrote what he thought, wrote what he believed.
Do you think Jamal had any idea that he was playing with fire?
I think that Jamal hadn't fully realized how different this system had become. I think that he thought that this was a regime that didn't draw blood unnecessarily, that did not kill dissidents overseas. And I think he was wrong. He misjudged how things had changed.
Hala, can you tell me what the effect was of hearing about his murder? This was not the sort of person you'd expect to be.
Not at all, no, not at all. But of course, the mounting, you know, hostility from the Saudi state and basically the accounts on Twitter. Twitter has been very much like the space for the Saudis to come together and express themselves in the absence of any kind of meaningful independent media. So to see Saud al-Qahtani creating blacklists of people, including myself and Jamal and others, who are outside and therefore can speak about issues of relevance. It was, you know, exactly, it's very much like disheartening for all of us not to be able to engage with the people as we relatively used to before. But the news of the killing were very much like unprecedented. The cruelty of this was very much the gruesome details of the murder were very much like shocking. Even for me, I couldn't believe it that happened. I kept on contacting other Saudis who fled to Turkey and to ask them, is that true? Can you go to the consulate and find out from the journalists and other Turkish people what happened? And one of them reached out in the second day saying, yes, in Turkey, there is a profound belief that he has been killed. So the initial reaction, we couldn't believe that he was killed. You know, it's just like 1 year after, less than a year actually, since he started talking and you know.
That this could happen to someone like him.
Like him, you know, he's not in opposition of the regime. He just wanted certain reforms, and you know, some of those reforms are in line with the state-led reforms. So we couldn't understand why did that happen, except, you know, his speech now became very much like independent from that of the state and shows how much, to which length the state is willing to go to. So yeah, it just created a moment of a turning point for many Saudis who were in the gray zone, still hoping for things to get better. And there might be some confusion around the crown prince, and you know, things will, with time will become more clear, and the reforms would somehow allow them more engagement and participation in their own countries. But the clarity of the murder, you know, it was a moment of clarity, really, created this kind of divide. So many people in the gray zone started talking out despite the risks and started changing camps. And yeah, it created like a shocking but very much like a sobering moment for many people.
Martin, I mean, part of the reason that this isn't supposed to happen somehow is that the international community won't allow it, or certainly a close ally of the United States isn't going to go doing this to a U.S. resident who writes for the Washington Post. So how does the White House's reaction, or lack thereof, play into this?
Well, if you remember, the first trip that President Trump took in his presidency was to Saudi Arabia, which is highly unusual to begin with. Usually you go to Canada or Mexico or Europe. He went to Saudi Arabia. His relationship with the Saudis has been tight throughout this whole period of, you know, from the Yemen war to the blockade of Qatar to the arrest at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel to the arrests and torture of the women. Every time there's an incident, he either phone calls or texts his approval. And the same thing was true after the execution, the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, is that he said, well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, we're with Saudi Arabia. There was no space that he was willing to give. We don't know what Pompeo or others said to Crown Prince, but there has been no sign that there's any distance between the administration and the Crown Prince.
But in your film, I mean, you discuss the fact that it within the U.S. government, there is knowledge about this, and that's it.
Well, the CIA believes that it was an order of the Crown Prince.
And that's not a hunch. I mean, they've got, describe the sort of evidence that you talk about.
Well, there's only one reporter who's been, after Pompeo came forward and said that there was no evidence, after the president made his statements, there was an employee in the CIA who was upset and leaked a copy of the report to a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, a fellow by the name of Warren Strobel, who I've known for many years. So he's seen the report, and everything in that report points to the Crown Prince as having played a role in ordering the murder.
Mm. Well, I'll just ask one more question of you two, and then we'll go to the audience, because I know you have a lot of questions and we want to hear them. But how has this changed your feelings as journalists, as columnists? I mean, I say from my own perspective, I traveled the world with this sense of that I had some protection this way. I mean, if you could broaden this out to worldwide for journalists doing international work, and Hala, maybe for you talking about the politics in the region.
Well, for us, very much, it's something that we have been foreseeing for a while as people who are members of the civil society in Saudi Arabia, not necessarily in line with the government policies on many issues. The dangers, as I've mentioned in my latest article, the mention of living under an absolute monarchy with complete monopoly over power and resources, this is what would be expected, that you know there will be no balances or checks against this kind of power to prevent such a heinous crime from happening. And to find this kind of support from international power because of the very much like the binary look at Saudi Arabia as either fostering Wahhabism or religious jihadism or importer of arms from the US. So basically it's a banking basically on Saudi Arabia, or on having Saudi Arabia as the police basically of the jihadis in the Middle East. This kind of very much like limited view of Saudi Arabia has really harmed the mechanisms, the organic mechanisms in which people could hold their government accountable. As for me as a person, it's very much like it shows why we felt like we had to speak out. We had to form associations or basically engage with the other civil societies around the globe in order to bring those issues into attention. So for me, I feel like it's somehow the murder of Khashoggi and the global coverage that it got basically became an opportunity for us to be heard. So it is a blessing in disguise, in a way.
It is an opportunity. It was an opportunity for me to get frontline to commission the film. I mean, there were times when I was talking to them about we should take a harder look at Mohammed bin Salman, but it wasn't until the murder of Jamal Khashoggi that there was an opportunity, that there was enough interest for us all to sort of open the window and look through it and see what was really happening inside Saudi Arabia. But I want to say that I want to give tribute to Hala, who has stepped into Khashoggi's shoes and is writing in the Washington Post. And it's Saudis like yourself who are most seriously at risk of seeing retribution from this regime. It's, I'm an American, there are some protections that come. I mean, it's a harder, I'm a harder target for them to consider going after. So I don't feel any risk, but for someone like you, I mean, hats off to you, and the courage that you've shown is truly.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program features the Colby College 2019 Lovejoy Award panel, honoring the journalists who sacrificed their lives in 2018. The panel will now answer questions from the audience.
This is a difficult and disturbing conversation to have with people who are engaged in making this history. But we'd like to invite you all into this. We have a tradition at Colby of a Q&A. I'd like to ask you, as I will right now, my name is Patrice Franco and I direct the Goldfarb Center, to introduce yourself. There are students standing in the aisles, so if you would raise your hand and let's continue this important conversation.
Tom Lynch, a parent, obviously a parent, or a really old freshman. So I guess the question, in hearing what you're saying, one of the worries I had when you look at this week, and we have a situation where the president invokes language of treason, and language of civil war, and language of and you said as an American you feel secure and safe and not really threatened. Can you comment about how, I'm sure there was a time in Saudi Arabia you felt safe too, and can you comment about how this could have implications for our freedom of the press in the US, and whether or not some of this dynamic that we're seeing in Washington could be playing out both on the right and the left? It's, you know, in both sides.
Well, listen, the harsh rhetoric that's been directed at the media that continues on a almost daily basis coming out of the White House is threatening to all of us. I think especially for those that work in repressive, extraordinarily repressive states overseas, you know, from the Philippines to Russia to Venezuela to Saudi Arabia. Those are where the threats are greatest, but it's harmful here as well. And now we've got half the population, it seems, not believing that anything we write or broadcast is true, which erodes all erodes trust throughout our society. So it's very concerning that we go forward with this kind of harsh rhetoric and distrust of the media. The fact is that everybody gets their information from the media, even those who are decrying the so-called fake news in the media.
Paul, do you want to build on this?
I don't want to be alarmist, I suppose, but the rule of law is something you can't really hold in your hands. It's kind of, it's just a bunch of people who deciding that they are going to follow the laws, and when you've worked in conflict zones or failed states, it becomes kind of real to you that when people stop sort of following those conventions, it might not happen very obviously at first. It might happen suddenly. It might not sort of give you the warning signs you would hope. And so whenever there's sort of a breakdown in some of these international norms that, you know, aren't always perfect and they're sometimes hypocritical. The United States used to spend a lot of time criticizing human rights records around the world when anyone who took a close look could see that the United States had a level of hypocrisy doing that. But everyone sort of agreed that there was this international consensus, this convention that the U.S. would be able to influence other countries that way. And when those conventions and those agreements to follow these sort of rules start falling away, they can fall away quicker and quicker and quicker.
In a very frightening way. Another question?
My name is Sarah Kaplan, and I'm a senior government and philosophy double major. One of the things I noticed in the clips that were just played was the comments on Twitter. I was wondering how the rise of social media, both domestically and internationally, has influenced the work that you do and the awareness that it's brought to the work that you do.
So I would say, you know, in places where the media is highly censored and controlled by the state, you know, the social media has provided people with voice and with ability to engage with like-minded people. And those political systems that really maintain power through monitoring the state, a police state, basically, you can't really have any kinds of associations. So it provided us with ways to reach out to each other, to influence the masses, and to exchange ideas that were very much challenging the state narrative or the norms, the approved norms, basically, the political norms. It was very powerful from the fact that someone like Jamal Khashoggi, who didn't do anything beside writing and commenting on Twitter, promoting his writings on Twitter, was murdered in such way. And of course, the torture that has been subjected, you know, the women activists have been subjected to, it just speaks volume on the impact that people who are only using social media because there are no other spaces to film themselves or others advocating for certain reforms, which are very much like in line with the developmental goals of the state, could pose a threat to the power of the system. So it is very much like the trigger for the Arab revolution, the mass revolutions, how people, you see in Iraq now, how the internet, because of the recent protests on the street, the first thing that the government has done is to cut off the internet. Same thing goes in Egypt, you know, this kind of intermittent blockage of the certain areas where people are often protesting in. So yes, the social media has been a platform for people not only to get to each other, but also for the government to use as a hunting ground and to promote those kinds of propaganda misinformation. Of course, President Trump is always on the social media and on Twitter. And I just add to the question on the rise, the concern over the rise of the hate speech and the hostility towards the media. It doesn't only affect the U.S. Environment, but it also gives this kind of impunity to leaders who are traditionally allies of the U.S. And of course, it's just very much like evident from the recent events, including the killing of Jamal.
Hala, you were saying before also that, I mean, the flip side of that, it's empowering social media, but it also for, you know, maybe journalists in this country who decide to report the war in Yemen or what's happening in Saudi or anywhere just from social media, that's risky also, right?
That is risky. Like we are starting as, you know, a group of dissidents, like three people outside the Saudis are starting podcasts in order to organize the public thinking around Khashoggi's killing, about feminism and the women's rights, about the rule of law, and hopefully about the war in Yemen as well, just providing a counter narrative to that of the state. And we haven't launched any sessions yet. We just, you know, in the October 2nd, we just announced the account. And each of us has received, you know, backlash from the state backed media. And, you know, our names were, our personal information that are informal records of the government, where I was born, where did I work, how much money the government spent on my education. It was very much like, and the accusations, like I'm a traitor who's an agent of the West. You know, the same things that goes against all the people who have independent voices. So those videos circulated immediately after we announced the account, even though we haven't launched any episodes yet.
Just a quick tag question before I turn to the back there. Martin, in your film, you're texting with the Crown Prince.
Yeah.
Yeah, he likes to text.
He likes to text. Can you say, this changes.
He's of that generation that likes to text, and yeah. I was happy to go there with him. I have a phone full of communication with him. He likes emojis a lot. But I just wanted to add that to this discussion of Twitter, that they were very aware of what happened in the Arab Spring and the power of social media and the power of Facebook and in the Egyptian Revolution. And so that's what Khatani was asked to do, was to take Twitter and turn it into an instrument of repression.
Yeah.
By loading it up with fake accounts that would distort. It was basically create a distortion field so that people looking at Twitter would think everybody loves the Crown Prince, when in fact it was an army of maybe 25 people in a room somewhere at the Royal Court that were flooding the internet with misinformation. And you know, we've now got an explosion of media in this country, and we've got a failure of our education system. At the same time, we're looking at 24 hours of information, and people don't have the capacity to even interpret the meaning of all this this noise. It's a lethal combination, and it's especially lethal in repressive societies where information is so tightly controlled and manipulated.
We have a patient questioner in the back there.
Hi, I'm Leighton Young. I'm a first year here, and I was wondering if you could, you've touched on it a little bit, if you could speak to the implications that the situation Saudi Arabia has to the global status of the freedom of the press.
I think Al Jazeera is a good example. So if you all heard about the crisis within the six Arab Gulf states, where there is a new regional coalition or order led by the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Israel, against Qatar, so they blocked Qatar altogether. They cut all the diplomatic and economic relations with the government of Qatar. And the first and foremost request that they had from Qatar is to shut down Al Jazeera, which is a global network that Qatar has been sponsoring since the 90s. It just became very much like the channel of use for many people to show the revolutions, the mass protests on the street in the Arab sphere, the diverse voices, which were very much like sidelined by the state-owned media in different countries. So you get to see how they now understand the power of the media and the power of the free press, and they're trying to control it in ways that involves the state heavily, like using the sanctions, using the economic and diplomatic means in order to coerce other governments who feel vulnerable enough, being at the crossfire between two powerful rivals in the region, Iran and Saudi Arabia, like Qatar. How do they use, they wield their power and project their power in order to control the narrative in the media? What kind of narrative that would prevent a recession of the, or basically revival of the Arab revolutions or mass protests or independent thoughts that would somehow provide a means to curb the power of those monarchies? So I think it's impossible. And even if Al Jazeera shut down completely, the international media could not do that. And it very much like depends on the how relevant and credible it is. And I think the role of the Washington Post, for instance, in promoting the Khashoggi's killing and basically raising this kind of sense of responsibility and accountability, keeping the whole idea of you know, protecting the journalists and providing a free space and safe place for journalists, is something that every journalist around the globe, even if the states would abandon, you know, and go back to certain red lines, journalists themselves, and you get to see them now, those who were part of the state-controlled media in Dubai, in UAE, in Saudi Arabia, who have migrated to places where they can write free, exactly like Jamal and others. It's impossible to control the journalists, even if you want to control the state-owned media. So there are repercussions. People are more and more afraid of delving into those kind of political, politically controlled conflicts. But at the same time, you get to see more interest because of that, because of the killing, to cover what are the rationale behind it.
How is it, how is the Saudi Crown Prince thinking? So there are more honest and serious coverage of Mohammed bin Salman or the Crown Prince and the UAE role in everything, and Egypt, of course, after the killing than it was before. So I think it somehow stimulated more of honest reporting.
Hello, my name is Joshua Kim. I'm a sophomore. I'm a sociology computer science double major. First of all, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, Hala, for the work that you're doing, even with all the risks that comes with it. But with that all being said, what is it that makes you turn to journalism and continue that, even while putting your life on the line for it?
I have a declaration, basically. I'm not a journalist. I'm not a journalist. I'm actually a scholar in women's health and social determinants of health.
So we'll take you as a journalist, yes?
Yeah.
We'll take
so,
you as a
so maybe, Martin, you can speak just for a second to the fact that there really aren't journalists
in
Saudi Arabia right now. Right?
I mean, that's the point. That's why Twitter was so important, because, I mean, journalists are basically the public. I mean, there are people who are trying to ferret out information and truth for the public. When there are no journalists, when journalists are all working for state-controlled newspapers, and therefore all information is state-sponsored, you have to default to something like Twitter or Facebook or some social media or outside journalists that are able to say more freely speak. So there are no journalists in Saudi Arabia to really.
Yeah, who can report, you know, without any kinds of bias or independently from that of from the line of the state. In Saudi Arabia, it's not only that you're silent. People were actually silent since Mohammed bin Salman came to power. But they're not really rallying behind his reform and promoting his reforms. So for that, we're not actually embracing his voice and promoting it. They were targeted.
Marty?
I'm Marty Kaiser. I'm on the selection committee. And I wondered, I'm sure you probably watched the interview on 60 Minutes with the Crown Prince.
Yeah.
I wondered if you'd comment on it and his remarks where he accepted responsibility.
You're really going to get me upset. I was quite upset about that interview. I had met with the Crown Prince in December of 2018, as you can see in the documentary, if you get a chance to see it. And he said essentially that same thing. He'd worked out his talking points with whatever consultant advised him. But he's not taking any responsibility truly for having ordered the killing. He's simply saying, I'm the Crown Prince. I mean, that's all he's declaring in that. I pressed him a little bit on that. They knew this biography was coming that took a deeper look at him. And so they came, I believe, to 60 Minutes, and they did that interview to try to get out ahead of what we were reporting on him. There were a lot of very simple questions that could have been directed to him that were not, and it was a lot of teeth gnashing in my home when I watched that. They're spending more and more money, millions of dollars. I think it was $34 million last year in Washington on lobbyists to try to spin their narrative. And I'm sorry, but and I would say this to my colleagues directly at 60 Minutes, but I believe that they were part of that.
You in your film, I mean, you've said that there's a link to Qahtani, and that's the closest link to Mohammed bin Salman. But from the CIA report, which Warren Strobel talks about, there's a line about maybe we should show him a bullet.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you think this, and we really should be thinking of this man, Mohammed bin Salman, as probably someone who knowingly ordered the grisly murder of someone who had essentially disrespected him on Twitter. Is that...
Well, what Quill's referring
correct
to...
Correct my character.
Yeah, no. What Quill's referring to is a conversation that was discovered after the fact of the murder by the NSA, the National Security Agency, when they went back through all their intercepts and they found a couple of conversations from 2017 in which the Crown Prince is talking first to Qahtani and saying, you know, this guy Khashoggi is getting a little too influential. We've got to do something about it. And interestingly, Qahtani warns him and says, well, maybe that would cause an international uproar if we were able to do something here. And the Crown Prince says back on the captured on this intercept, Saudi Arabia should not care about what the world thinks.
About a few weeks later, there's another conversation with another aide in which they pick up in The Intercept that the Crown Prince is also still worried about what to do with Khashoggi. And he says, maybe we should go get him. And if he resists, we should show him a bullet. So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There was a fellow last night who was an attorney. I don't know if he's here today, but he came up to me afterwards and he says, you know, most murder cases are built on circumstantial evidence, and he thought there was enough of it here to convict the Crown Prince. Mm-hmm. But this is the problem. He's not being subjected to a real investigation. You can't trust the Saudi court. They're declaring the Saudi Crown Prince innocent of this crime even before the investigation that they say is ongoing is complete, which makes no sense. They're claiming it's a rogue killing. And the UN hasn't really put its full muscle behind an investigation. And certainly the Trump administration doesn't want to see a robust investigation.
And next month he's having his Davos in the desert. And even the people who stayed away last year are now figuring it's safe to show our faces there.
And the G20 meeting will be next year in Riyadh.
Yeah. In Riyadh.
I'm Russell Workman. I'm a spouse of a faculty member. And I'm also a high school teacher. And I was interested in what you said about, well, two things. One, the overwhelming amount of information that people have to process that's in, you know, the distortion field that they run into. And then also how people put their lives on the line to get out what they think of as the truth. And I'm curious, being as it were at a college, what you think the implications for education are.
Well, I think we just have a bigger uphill fight to keep up with the amount of media distortion and information that's out there. We all have to be smarter to wend our way through all the noise that is we're subjected to on a daily basis. And when people are not well educated, it's very difficult for them to assess what's true and what's not true. I think that it's a tremendous challenge for anyone who's in the field of education. And I consider myself in the field. I work for the WGBH Educational Foundation. That's that's the home of Frontline. And our programs are put out there to try to give people real information as best as we can determine it.
Hi. My name is Veronica Romero. I'm from class of 2009 and current faculty in psychology. I'm from Venezuela, and you mentioned how the situation over there is also precarious. And in multiple different instances, you've talked about international pressure and how sometimes it works, but not really, especially in these situations. What do you both think we can do from our position of privilege here in the U.S., where there are these laws and we have a certain amount of freedom of expression, to change some of these situations going on around the world? Yeah. Thanks.
Well, I would say I was very happy after the murder that the Washington Post decided to create the Khashoggi's Fellowship. I was trying as much as possible not to be the sole voice, because I've been talking a lot all over the place, and I wanted basically other people to be involved as well. And my understanding is that a voice from Saudi Arabia would be very relevant to the fellowship, to the first fellow of the Khashoggi's Fellowship. So I agreed, despite the fact that I didn't really have a lot of time. But I felt like at the time, it's the idea that someone from the same country, someone who had been through the more or less the same journey of oppression, to be able to find a platform where they can have control over their own voices, what can they say, what messages they want, both the Saudis, because it's translated into Arabic, and the audience in the US and globally, to hear about Saudi Arabia, this kind of power, is somehow, you know, very much lacking generally. So for me, I felt like this is, though I wouldn't be able to contribute as much as I want to, but at least the idea that there is a platform here, and there is a stand that could be embraced by other Saudis. And I've seen that. I just talked about the podcast and the reactions. So I think what we were deprived a lot, and the main reason why we're targeted is the association and the freedom of expression. And these two things are very much doable and possible in the liberal democracies for people living outside, despite the risks involved. So I think our job is to amplify the voices of those who were not able to speak out and to provide more of an organic views on Saudi Arabia more than the bandits of the of DC, who might be very much like influenced by those in power in those countries, whether it's in Venezuela or elsewhere, to provide average citizens who are not part of any kinds of institutions or think tanks or power structures, the ability to voice their own concerns and to have their voices part of the power structure and contention. I think that in itself, to provide those kinds of platforms and to seek the associations, to build those kinds of associations that we were deprived of, and to basically partner with like-minded people, not necessarily within Saudis or in Venezuelans, but people who are believing in build a society on values rather than on nationalities, that is empowering in and of itself.
I just want to stress that these outside voices are heard within these. Well, I can speak to Saudi Arabia specifically because that's what I spent my last year thinking and focusing on and traveling to. But these voices can be heard with virtual private networks. Blockages that are put in place by governments can be avoided. You can get on the internet. You can see stuff. So this is, I mean, one should not despair. And the reason that these governments are so aggressive in monitoring the internet is because they know we live in the information age and they can't stop it. And so they're trying to fight back from their side. But these voices can be heard. And so I think the job is to, for all of us to write and speak and be heard.
Well, yeah, I mean, the case in Venezuela probably also speaks to how difficult it is, even when you have a huge consensus building around the hemisphere on you know, taking action about what's happening there. So, I mean, even when you have intervention, obviously, I think we've seen the last bunch of years, doesn't always work the way you want it to. It's tricky. But in terms of what we can do, I don't know, I'm preaching to the choir, but you all coming out to forums like this is one step, and supporting them and hearing these voices. And then, like Martin said, just speaking out yourselves to your community here and your friends and your family and sort of making sure that there are a lot of voices saying, well, we care about these issues in our country and in others, and letting maybe people who are on the fence know that you're there by being, you know, speaking up, so they'll know maybe if they were quiet about it, they could speak up too.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured the 2019 Lovejoy Award panel discussion at Colby College, honoring the journalists who sacrificed their lives in 2018. If you missed part of the program or want to hear it again, you can always find it on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on radio to access this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from our alarm clock. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Lucy Suchek. Thanks for joining us.